In this episode of Pemba On Demand, from Kandahar to COVID, leadership lessons from the past quarter century, my guest is Dr. Christopher Chisholm, CMO for Swedish Health Systems in Seattle, Washington, which is affiliated with Providence St. Joseph Health. Chris joined Swedish following a 20-year career in naval medicine. His insights on the similarities and differences between physician leadership in naval medicine versus civilian medicine are really valuable. Welcome to Pemba On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of different healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare, career development, and healthcare leadership. The information provided in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute professional or legal advice. The views and opinions expressed by me, the host, or guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the University of Tennessee or any other organization we are affiliated with. I'm pleased to have as our guest today Dr. Christopher Chisholm. Chris is a fellow Pemba alumnus, graduating from the most recent class in 2024. Dr. Chisholm trained in emergency medicine and, as you will hear today, has a very interesting journey to share. Our topic today, the title of our show, is From Kandahar to COVID, Leadership Lessons from the Past Quarter Century. Chris, welcome to Pemba On Demand.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the invitation.
It's great to have you on the show. When we were coming up with the title, I wondered whether you would be a little bit nervous about the last quarter century part of it, but
I saw that. I'm like, and then I got some comments from folks about quarter century. I guess I look old enough to play the part, so I don't know.
Well, it's nice that when we look the age, it gives us a lot of credibility, right? So
I hope that's what it gives us. I'm not. that's what I want to believe.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. I thought we could start by just talking a little bit about your current role with Swedish Health Systems as the chief medical officer. Not everybody is really familiar with what chief medical officers do, and I think it changes from organization to organization. So maybe you could share with us some of the main responsibilities and the scope of your current role.
Appreciate the question. I think what I've learned working and talking with other chief medical officers is that if you see one, you've seen one. And in my role, we have four hospitals and an ER that's part of a bigger, so that's Swedish, legacy Swedish, and it's part of a bigger Providence system of 51 hospitals. And so in my current role, I oversee product lines, the hospital product lines, so women and children, surgery and acute care. And then also as duties as assigned, I think as a CMO, when anybody who's done it, you duties as assigned is really whatever comes up. And in our hospital, it's for me, it's GME. We have 200 residents and fellows, plus a lot of learners that come through our system. And then research, we do a significant amount of research. So we probably have 700 plus studies that go on in our institution. So also med staff relations and then contract management, mostly for call contracts and medical director oversight, but significant contract work as well. So some of that's kind of happened over time, and some of it was what they told me when I got here, and a lot of it was what I learned on the job.
How long have you been in the role with Swedish?
I started at First Hill 4 years ago, and then over the last 4.5 years, it's grown to four hospitals in the ED. So about 4 years total. It was the job I took when I left the Navy.
Was the integration of Swedish into Providence, was that something that happened prior to your arrival, or did you work through and navigate through that merger and acquisition?
I'd say both. It happened in 2012, I believe. So it happened way before I got here. But I think culturally, it's something that we're still working through. We're much further along in the journey than we were. But I think, I don't know, I can't speak for every organization that does this, but I've seen a few others that when you merge two large and prominent organizations, and Providence being much larger than us, there's growing pains, and then there's integration issues. And we've worked through it. I think we're better for it. I think we're stronger as a team, but I can't say that it's been completely seamless, but I think definitely worthwhile. COVID proved that too. Like if we weren't a team during COVID, we would have really suffered.
So you mentioned that you took this job as you retired from naval medicine. How did your experiences in military medicine, naval medicine, really prepare you well for civilian healthcare leadership?
You know, I really appreciate that question. And I think a lot of it has to do with the military prepares you, whether they mean to or not, for with leadership because of the responsibility. So very early on, everybody's got a set number of years in your career, and most people don't do more than 20 if they do that. So you're dealing with a workforce that is required to step up and do leadership jobs very early on, and they train you for that, mostly because of the mission requirements. And then there's on-the-job training that goes along with how you pick up and new job, like every 2 or 3 years, you change jobs. So how do you integrate with a new group? How do you motivate them and build trust and relationships and then accomplish the mission in very short time increments and then move on? So there's always a sense of urgency, and there's always a sense of mission that I think is your, it's ingrained in you in the military. And then I think how you translate that is the trick, because it's also different with the military. The way some choose to motivate in the military is doesn't always translate well to the civilian sector.
You mean because of the use of the authority gradient and other levers that they have to pull on in the military versus civilian?
I love the term authority gradient. I'm going to use that. But yeah, I think in the military, you have the luxury or liability, depending on how you look at it, of rank structure. And I think very, very often rank structure is required in the military. And so I think at the basic level, when everybody comes in, rank structure helped us accomplish really difficult missions with people who came from extremely diverse backgrounds. But even in the military, the higher up the teams got, and you know, there's always, people always like to use flight. I was a flight surgeon for a while. So the flight crews and the aircraft carriers and special forces too. So some watching some of them, they operate at a very high level, and you don't, especially in the special forces folks, you don't always know who's in charge by the way they look or walk, but they all know. So they've learned how to kind of matrix their own situation because they've evolved and become a little bit more advanced. But I do think the military does use a very structured rank system, which is useful for most things. I found in the civilian sector, the matrix organization allows a lot more ideas to float up. And sometimes that's great. And sometimes that's not so great.
How long had you been in the military before you had your first formal leadership role? And how did they prepare you for that?
I am an ER. I'm a recovering ER physician. So I was doing regular shifts in the emergency department down in San Diego. And then I did training down there. And then I ended up deploying as a trauma team lead down in Afghanistan. And when I got back, I wanted to do a chest pain center. So I had previously done a master's and a fellowship at Stanford in chest pain, cardiovascular emergencies, because I thought, like back in 2010, we were all going to open, ER docs were all going to open chest pain centers and revolutionize cardiac care across the planet. Well, you know, the Affordable Care Act came along, that kind of went away. So what's plan B? And then the Navy kind of forces you to say, if you want to make rank, if you want to make the next step, you're going to have to do something than just your clinical job. So I wouldn't say reluctantly, but it wasn't my first choice. I asked if I could be part of or be considered for leading a small clinic. And so I started out by leading a small clinic, and really it was the people around me. The clinic knew how to run itself. It just, who should we hire? What are some of the decisions we should make? But the experts were already in the clinic. So the way they taught me is that everybody in their own pipeline had already learned their job, and they just kind of needed people to bring the decisions and the ideas together and kind of formulate a plan. And it went really well. So between that, from that clinic to multiple clinics, from multiple clinics to XO of the trauma hospital in Kandahar to CMO Balboa, it just went from there.
So it sounds like one of the lessons you learned in spite of the rank structure is that frontline staff who really know their job are a huge asset to a leader in an organization.
100%. I think they're the key. One thing that I did learn in the Navy that it has carried over is if you think you're going to walk in and be the expert in that situation, even if it's your specialty, you're probably misguided. I think if you are able to set up a structure where people feel able to come to you with problems and concerns and questions in an open environment, and then listen to them because they're the experts and you're willing to kind of consider, but then help make decisions in a team structure, you'll be a lot more successful. If you walk in and pretend like you know what you're doing and try and lord over folks, you're going to get yourself in trouble.
You already mentioned the differences in structure of civilian versus military organizations. Was that the biggest challenge or difference you faced when adjusting to the civilian healthcare system? Or was there some other challenge or opportunity that you found when you transitioned into civilian healthcare?
You know, like you'd have to ask the people I work with to trust but verify anything I'm saying. But I think one of the bigger challenges was the financial aspect. So in the Navy, you're basically given a budget. and the leadership in the Navy, especially the COs and XOs, they have to kind of make what their mission work within the budget they're given by Congress, as opposed to the civilian sector. We kind of can make our own budget, but we have to actually hit the numbers we project. So we have a budget system, as you're aware, and as your viewers are aware, that you project your budget, then you have to make your own budget, like you've designed it. So in that sense, it was a little bit different, but quite honestly, how you get there is not much different. I think what the Navy allowed is that you had a ability to fall back on positional authority a lot more in the Navy, but you really didn't get as much unless you used influence in civilian medicine, especially for CMOs. We are almost a 90% influence brand. Like, we do things through influence. And so I think making sure that you were able to switch the over from not relying, I tried not to in the Navy. You never know how much you were perceived as, but you really couldn't do it in the civilian sector. It had to be influence and it had to be team building, and because there is no hierarchy is frowned upon, I guess is one way to say it.
It was kind of interesting as we're having our conversations preparing for this. One of the things that fascinated me, and it gets back to the team building that you just alluded to, and we were talking about your deployment to Kandahar, time-based challenges that you face preparing for that deployment, and the challenges of the mission itself. I wonder if you could talk with us a little bit about that kind of time frame and what you had to achieve and how much time they gave you to achieve that.
So we were on ground for 6 months. So we ran the hospital for 6 months, but we prepped for about 2 to 4 months, depending on the person and the job type. So we were a trauma hospital, so we had orthopedic surgeons, we had a neurosurgeon, we had several general acute surgeons, and also ICU docs, ICU nurses, and everybody is coming from, it's not all from the same hospital, we came from around the country. And so we had a very short time frame to build a team and then also prepare for the jobs we had to do, because we couldn't go there and just enjoy to be with each other. We had to accomplish a mission. And I think a lot of the training was done separately, so that didn't help in the first 2 to 4 months. So some people went to like hospitals around the country that had super high acuity that could prepare them for combat medicine. And then we came together in several different evolutions to do combat simulation, mostly combat medical simulation. So like how to work as a team. And so I think the simulations really helped us as a team, but then also the time between the simulations, they put us in isolated conditions during training so that we were, even though we were not actually in country, we were together as a team away from everybody else. And I think that allowed us an opportunity to kind of forge who we were going to be and why we were going to be who we are and develop our own personality as a unit. And I think once we brought everybody's concerns or desires into the mix and we kind of developed what we all wanted to be, those 2 to 4 months were fast, but we put it to good use.
So you contrast that. You mentioned that Providence came into being or started working with Swedish in a different way 10 or 12 years ago. And you contrast the length of time it takes to bring a medical staff cohesion and collaborative work when there's an integration or a merger like that. It's very different than you basically had 2 months to stand up a hospital with all sorts of different specialties. That's got to be very different than what you see when you're trying to develop a highly functional team within the civilian sector.
No, that's a great point. I think what I would say to that is the one thing about the deployment piece is that you were able to pull people out 100% out of their normal life and put them into a situation where it was sink or swim. So there was a codependency on each other that you don't see when you do these larger mergers. So we still, like when two large hospital systems come together, you have to still make the budget you designed, right? And so you can't pull people out lock, stock, and barrel out of a service line. You have to find a way to integrate them. And then because there are so much, it's such a complicated system in the civilian sector to integrate two groups and to stay functional and to stay on as close as you can to budget, especially during the things we faced in the last 10 years. I just think it's 10 years seems like 2 months. I think that I would say that's a fair equivalent. It's not a slam on either process.
Well, it's interesting because when you came into the civilian sector, you were faced with a pandemic, a COVID pandemic that really did create a high stakes situation. Talk a little bit about how your experience in quickly developing and deploying a team in the military sector helped you adjust to that situation.
Yeah, I think a lot of it had to do just with flexibility and being able to pivot. And You know, I think as an ER physician, that is not something we all are trained in that when we, as part of residency, because you never know what's coming through the door. I think other specialties are not necessarily as adept at that. So kind of using some of the skills you learn in the emergency department and the military and our experience was, how do you pivot? How do you change the trajectory of what you're doing in a fairly short amount? I mean, you know, the IV fluid shortage that we recently have felt like a mini COVID because we, and that was even more abrupt. Like that was over a matter of days that we had to adjust to that. So I think really just kind of resetting goals and expectations. And that's what we do in all situations. And what I do find is that in healthcare, physicians, APCs, nurses, all of our workers, all of our caregivers, I think we all have the same why at their base, which is this is something we do as part of a calling and not necessarily, there's easier ways to make money. I've said that before, but we do healthcare because it's a calling. And I think when we all see that the situation is bigger than us and we have to move, people will move. I think they get frustrated when they see that the situation is being, they feel like the situation is being manipulated and it's not something bigger than us. It's something that's being done for reasons other than necessity. And I think COVID was one of those things where you didn't have to convince people we were in a difficult situation. And it's amazing how quickly and flexible people can be when they feel like they need to be. There's no shortage of stories of people achieving more and doing greater things than even they thought they could during times of stress. So I think COVID was one of those times.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/POD podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. We talked about the differences between the time that you had to get your team ready when you were deploying in theater in Kandahar to civilian sector in general. I've always been fascinated by the role that communication plays in developing a highly functional team and developing trust and collaboration within a newly formed team. And I find that that's one of the biggest challenges that I've always struggled with is how do you communicate? How do you create effective communication? What does the military do to try to make sure everybody's getting on the same page? And how have you or have you been able to bring any of those tools into your civilian role?
I think as I was thinking about as you were asking the question, the military again is able to pull you out and put you in situations where you are 100% devoted to that team at that point. And that's special and unique. But I think even in those situations, it's the same process. It just sped up. And the way communication, in my opinion, so when I was in Kandahar, my skipper, the CO, I was the XO, the skipper was a nurse, and then our senior enlisted was a senior chief. And so we first got together and made sure that we were on the same page. Are we all going to speak with one voice? And then when we did, and we all felt like we had common understanding of what our goals were as leaders for the team, then we talked to the team. And I think having the team kind of voice what they wanted to get out of this and what their concerns and fears and expectations were, and then making sure that we fashioned a set of goals and standards that we all wanted to achieve so that when we felt like we were falling short as leaders, we would just remind folks of the goals we all set. And as the folks that helped set the goals, they recognize that this is what we had all committed to. And I think that's not different than what we do in civilian healthcare. It takes longer because it's a much, much more complex process. But the communication is, what is our common goal? What is the common theme of what we're trying to achieve? Do we all agree with that? And then whether you agree with the fine details or not, if we're heading in that direction, it's an easier argument to make. So I think right now the common enemy is the difficult healthcare landscape. And I think mm-hmm. I don't want to, I hesitate to call any group out as being the problem, right? Because eventually it'll be us. Like, it'll be the doctors, it'll be the APCs, it'll be the hospitals. So I don't like to say who is or who isn't the problem. I would say that we are all, from the payers, the hospitals, the ambulatory systems, all the ancillary services, we are all invested in making healthcare work in the current environment. And I think that's a big enough challenge that we can all rise up to. And if the answer is we all can get buy-in that we're headed in that direction, when you have things that are more granular and you're having difficulties with eight different groups, but we've all agreed we're fighting a common cause, people will at least be willing to accept your plan, or at least discuss a plan rather than dismiss you out of hand.
One of the things that struck me as being different between your deployment and what we see in civilian healthcare at times is that there's a more definitive time frame for how long you're going to complete the mission. COVID, I think, was a good example. And some of the other challenges we face now, just we don't necessarily see an end in sight. How do you incorporate tools to try to reduce stress and burnout amongst team members, encouraging resilience and that sense of purpose that you talked about, when there just doesn't seem to be light at the end of the tunnel?
It's interesting too, because there's a little bit of guilt too in the current military, not for me, not talking about, but from my experience in the military, because you look back at World War II and those folks had the same situation. They deployed and they came back when it was done. They didn't come back after the modern military has evolved into deployments because we recognize there's a limit to the effectiveness. And I think that's something that if you have the luxury of limiting stuff because of, you know, your effectiveness is going to wear off. And I think that's going back to the resident hour. So I think that was something that was interesting that developed, but in general, I think it's a good thing because we limit what we know is not good after a certain point. When you can't, to your question, and in my experience, you know, there's speeches you can give, but speeches don't do a whole lot. I mean, that you can talk to people kind of, I think if you're doing larger group meetings, it's reminding people the North Star and what we all agreed on. But in reality, people are tired and they're burnt out and they're frustrated and they don't think anybody hears them and they don't know how to express it. And so if the end is not in sight, what I found is that in COVID and then also in my deployments was just listening to people one-on-one, like, tell me where you're at, tell me what's going on in your life, and then not trying to solve it, because really everybody's story's different and they don't need my solutions, but who do you talk to about it? And then just letting them know we appreciate their efforts. Like, what you're doing matters, what you're doing counts. I know what you're going through is different than everybody else, because by definition, everybody's journey's different, but hey, thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for pitching in, and you're making a difference. And I know it comes at a cost. So acknowledging the cost and then acknowledging their contribution and then basically leaving it at that. I think when you try and solve people's problems when they're burnt out or frustrated, unless it's something like we should be having, we can fix it with supplies, or we can fix it. Like, if there's a fix, then as an administrator, I should try and fix it. But if there's something you can't fix, and it's just a matter of acknowledgement and gratitude.
As I've been listening to your answer, I thought of another question, and I know I've had experiences with healthcare providers who go through a lot of stress, or they have a situation in their personal life which really starts to impact their performance, and they really just can't maintain a level of performance. In the military, was that something that you had the ability to respond to? I mean, did you have the luxury of being able to take someone offline, for example, or off duty when they really weren't able to function for whatever reason, the stress of being in country, things going on back at home that they felt like they needed to deal with, et cetera?
For sure. The military they've got a really good system of building in redundancy and finding ways to have the next person step up. And that's kind of what the military motto is next person up. And it doesn't always work out perfectly. There are times when you go to the shelf and there's nobody left, but for the most part, you can either transfer to another facility, or other specialties can cross cover, even though it's slightly out of their specialty, but they know enough to get by. Because you're not, when you're forward, especially people that were forward of us in the smaller operating bases, it's not definitive surgery. It's pale, you know, you're trying to just get them to the next level. And so, yeah, in that sense, we also recognize when people were past the point where it's like safety in any situation. If somebody's actually more dangerous, they need to come offline. And I think that's something that we all have recognized, civilian or military, in safety and quality, is when it's time to come offline, it may seem like it's really difficult to do. There are, like, I hate to speak in definitives. Like, there's times when we have to have somebody work more than they need to work because there's no other alternative. But I think that's the exception rather than the rule.
Thank you. I think it's a challenge. All of us face challenges when we have people that we count on. I think creating redundancy in the civilian sector, I think, is a little bit challenging. I have never practiced in the military, obviously, but I know that having the capability where you have an excess staffing situation and you can pull people, even covering call when people go on vacation, sometimes seems like an insurmountable challenge. And
that's true.
And that's kind of planned vacations. That has nothing to do with somebody dealing with a life crisis or getting sick or something like that. So it's just,
well, I agree. But I do think there's a difference too. And I wouldn't say that the staffing in the military was not, I wouldn't say extra or more. I just think there's, because if you're in a deployed situation, the urgency and planning around that is much more than your back home time. And so in that sense, but I would say even in the civilian sector, the discussions we have about call coverage and people taking vacations, those are, I want to use the term peacetime, but when we're not in crisis, those bubble up. Those bubble up, military or civilian. So mm-hmm. If you're back at home and you're back at home base, daily life stuff bubbles up. When you hit a crisis like COVID, I didn't sense a lot of people struggling to step up to do the right thing, right? So I think if you, in those moments, people tend to, and then you got to be careful that people aren't overworked. I think that's what I'm trying to say, is that's when you got to watch folks who are trying so hard that they're pushing themselves past what they should push themselves.
I think crisis management and what you dealt with, obviously, in the military and then coming back to COVID, and you mentioned the crisis with IV fluid and those types of things. In the military, team is specifically prepared or expects high stress situations. And you mentioned some of the simulation testing that they go through. Have you found that the lack of simulation testing in the civilian side is something that you've tried to address, or is that not something that you've focused on since you assumed your role at Swedish?
Oh, simulation, I think, is a really big deal. We have a very advanced simulation center. I think the problem really isn't so much the ability to do, it's the time to do simulation. Mm-hmm. Like, it is something where finding a way to prioritize it, because you don't get paid. There's no RVU for simulation, right? So I do think we've done a good job, at least in our system, of coming up with a simulation plan. What I found is that there are folks that realize that once they've done it, they miss it and they want it back. So we've got a couple of specialties right now that are really trying to fight to get time back in the simulation center, because they've realized that when you don't have it and you go to a couple of RCAs and people who've experienced simulation and people who haven't, and then they go to a root cause analysis after an untoward outcome, they recognize that it could have been better had they done more simulation. So I think what we have is a situation where, how do you incentivize people who are not paid to do simulation? Like, we can pay the staff to run the simulation, but to get the physicians involved. And I think that is something that's growing, and we're big advocates of it. I'm an advocate of it because we did a lot of simulation in the Navy. Because the model of remuneration or payment is different, it's not as simple as just saying, hey, Tuesday, we're all going to the sim center. Like, you, it's just not what you can do in the civilian sector. But I think the value is something that is continuing to gain momentum, and for a good reason too. People see the benefit of it once they've been through it, especially multidisciplinary. I think if you have not just the physician or APC, but the whole team working together, and how you work with pharmacy and all that, I think the value is massive.
Yes, I agree. I know in a lot of the safety leadership lessons that I've learned and working with different safety leaders across the country, trying to, even using small simulations at the bedside or in the clinical space where you don't have to pull the team into a sim center, have been found to be an effective way to train. And I think that's much more cost effective in our healthcare systems. But certainly having the large sim centers that have grown up give us a totally different opportunity than I had when I was going through my training. Those just weren't really possible. They didn't even exist. And now the technology has gotten so much better. It's amazing what they can accomplish in a simulation.
Yeah, some of those simulators were so realistic. It was anxiety provoking that you were. Yeah. Anyways, no, I agree.
So a couple of questions. I want to kind of pivot a little bit before we get to the end of the show. And I wondered if you could reflect a little bit your MBA. I know it's very early. You just kind of finished your MBA, but what was your primary motivation for attending Pemba? What did you expect to get out of it?
Well, what I went there to get really was more of a perspective, because I basically chosen as a physician to do administration, right? So as a physician, we spend all this time understanding medicine, residencies and fellowships and clinical rotations. And then we go over to administration and we're like, well, I'll just take it off the cuff. Like I'll give it my best shot. I felt like I wasn't doing the job credit. Like, I don't know that I'm Wharton School of Business ready to run my off. Did something happen?
No, you're on.
Okay. But it's a great education. It's a great school. It's the level. I think the folks that are in the MBA courses that are pure business are really amazing. But I was able to learn the language and speak it and feel more like I was preparing myself for my life in administration with understanding the way the business side thinks, and at least educating myself as to this, the basics of, you know, money management and building a pro forma and the different parts of marketing and stuff that you need to, I don't know, as a physician, you always feel like you should be preparing your training. And this was like administrative training. And I thought it hit all those. I have to say what I learned most, first of all, University of Tennessee was an amazing experience. I would recommend it to anybody for physicians. I think it's probably I've had a lot of friends that are physicians that consider MBAs, and University of Tennessee is always my first choice, because for physicians, I don't think there's a better program in the country, because they help you as a physician integrate it. You're not in a group with it. Everybody's a doc in that group. But it's also humbling, because the people I met in the group, I actually probably learned as much or more from. Like, we're talking about military, but I had a friend in that class who was a former Army Ranger. So he can tell you more about the military. There's a couple of ladies that are CMOs of much larger institutions than the ones that I'm work. So that, you know, we have CEOs. There is a gentleman there who's a CEO physician, who's a CEO of a hospital. So I think listening to those folks and their opinions, it was humbling, because you think you have this great insight and perspective, and then you realize there's other opinions that honestly are often better than yours.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to have to cut this a little bit shorter than I anticipated. I'm getting a message of a technical issue that I have here. So I'm going to ask you one last question. So what advice would you have for me, for physician leaders, people who are just starting out in their career? Are there two or three key things that you think have helped you really build high performing teams in the challenging environments that you face in your career, both military and civilian?
Yeah, I would say recognize that you're not the expert and that you're really the person who's supposed to bring the experts together. Build consensus, but don't rely on that as your leadership style, as far as you have to help make decisions, but the experts will help you make the right decision if you listen and build consensus. You know, basically build a scaffolding and then let the experts amaze you, and they will. If you build a scaffolding that is calm and consistent, the experts will fill it in and amaze you every time. Give yourself grace to fail. I think as physicians, we always recognize that it takes a while to kind of learn the skill. As leaders, I think sometimes we think every meeting and every interaction we have is going to be a home run. In reality, oftentimes you come out, like I'm telling myself this one right now, because I'm still working on my day-to-day interactions and how I interact with people, and having grace to allow yourself to fail as you grow as a administrator and a leader, as you did when you were a physician. And I think they're not too dissimilar.
Great. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time with us today. I apologize for the audience that we're having to cut this a little bit short, but I think that this has been a great live stream, and I appreciate you taking the time out to join us. And hopefully we'll get a chance to check back in with you and have you back on the show at some point in the future.
No, I'd love to. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed our Pemba On Demand episode today with Chris. Thank you for taking the time to listen. My guest on the next episode of Pemba On Demand is Zach Buck, JD. Zach is a professor of law at the University of Tennessee. Zach and I will be discussing the impact of administrative law in healthcare and the impact on you as providers. One particular Supreme Court decision impacting the balance of power between Congress and executive branch agencies will receive special attention. In the following episode, my guest will be Dr. Archie Bella. Dr. Bella is the guest on Pemba On Demand live stream that will be airing on March 18th. We will release it in podcast form. Archie is the CEO of Opsum Health an FQHC located just south of San Diego, California. We look forward to having you benefit from the content in both of these future episodes.
Pemba On Demand is released bi-weekly, every other Thursday, and available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Castos, or Overcast. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast player by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could share the podcast with your friends or colleagues. You can also listen to our podcasts on our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/@PembaOn-demand, all one word, no spaces. Please hit the like button and subscribe. Also, if you have any comments or questions regarding this or other episodes, please feel free to add them into the comment section on our YouTube channel. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to our website and our YouTube channel in the show notes. The website is tiny.utk.edu/PembaOnDemand, all one word. There's no hyphen in that URL. You will find the links to the episodes there. Please also check the show notes for links that were discussed in the show today. Take good care of yourselves and become an even bigger force for good in healthcare.